All the wayward wind is a restless wind. How restless wind.
Good morning. It's not working. Good morning. Welcome, guests, to Downtown Crossroads. This is our sixth show. We have a very special guest, our second religious leader from downtown, right before the Jewish holidays. Rabbi Moshe Greenwald is going to talk to us about everything that comes up, but how his faith intersects with downtown Los Angeles will be our main topic. Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning, Ed. Thank you for having me on. It's a big honor.
Well, it's our pleasure. And we want to get right into the show by asking you some questions about yourself.
Go for it.
Rabbi, which were the main and early influences in your life that made you want to be a rabbi?
I was brought up the son of a rabbi. We can trace back, my family can trace back nine generations of rabbis from the Holy Land in Israel. And growing up the son of a rabbi, I was exposed to the job and what it entails from a very early age, although I wasn't quite sure that I would do it until I was about 16 or 17, and that became a calling. And after giving it a lot of thought, I decided that this would be the best and most productive way that I can live my life and live life to the fullest of my potential.
Can you tell us the difference between a calling and an obligation?
Well, I think a calling comes from somewhere very deep. You know, we all have obligations in life. Some of it is family, some of it is communal, and all of us should take our obligations very seriously. But a calling, I think, it comes from even a deeper source. And a calling is something which I think that the person with that calling cannot rest unless they do the work and the life, because it's not a job, it's really a life that the calling is urging me on for.
But do you have other brothers and sisters that also became rabbis, or are you the only one in the family?
Well, actually, I'm the oldest of seven, and I have three brothers and three sisters. All three of my brothers became ordained as rabbis. However, at the moment, none of them are working in the capacity of a rabbi. Actually, all three of them are in business at the moment. One of my sisters married a rabbi, and they live in San Clemente, California, and they run the Jewish Community Center there.
Can you tell us about Chabad? What attracted you to Chabad? Was your dad a Chabad rabbi, or was he part of a different part of Judaism? Tell us about Chabad and how it compares to the rest of the Jewish community.
Oh, absolutely. Well, first, if I may, let me give you a little bit of background on what Chabad is. Because Chabad to many is an enigma, and to many, it's a misunderstood force of Judaism or brand of Judaism. Chabad sometimes is known as a sect or a group. I think that Chabad is more a philosophy and a movement and a way of life. Chabad was started in the Russian, in the Tsarist Russians, in the late 1700s. It was a branch of the Hasidic movement.
Wow, I didn't know it was that old.
Yeah. Chabad is very old. And it goes back to a time when the Jewish people living in the Eastern Europe region underwent a tremendous amount of suffering and underwent a tremendous amount of hardship, both externally due to anti-Semitism, due to financial constraints, due to inability to practice and to live a free life, as the Tsarist government didn't allow them to. But also internally, the Jewish people were fragmented, where you had on one side the sages, the Torah scholars, the leaders who were gifted both monetarily as well as being able to go to the yeshivas. The yeshivas are the rabbinical schools, and to study and to know a lot of the Bible, of the Talmud, of the Mishnah. And they looked down at the regular Jews, the rest of the population, who I would say were about 80% of the population, were the people who weren't able to go to the yeshivas, and they weren't able to study, and therefore they were ignorant. Came the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, who taught that the way to serve God is not only through study, not only through through learning the Torah, but also through joy and love and worship. And he started what's called the Hasidic movement. The Hasidic movement today is, its elements have touched every branch of Judaism, whether it's Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist. All elements of Orthodoxy have undercurrents of Hasidic teachings and thoughts in it. Now, Chabad...
So Chabad came out of Hasidism?
Yes, Chabad was one of the leading Hasidic groups founded by Rabbi Shneur Zalman, who wrote a famous esoteric book on esoteric works called the Tanya. And the Chabad movement actually is an acronym for Chachma, Bina, and Dat, which means wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. That the greatest capacity that we were blessed with as human beings were our minds. We could serve God and a fellow man through action. We could serve God and fellow man through love. But we also can use our highest intellect, which is the faculty of thought, the faculty of the processing of the mind, to understand the workings of God, to understand the underlining elements of the universe, which is all spirituality, which is all goodness, and to bring that forth. And so Chabad has been, for the last seven generations, through the Chabad leaders, which we call Rebbes. Rebbe means teachers, has been on the forefront of disseminating Judaism and disseminating the teachings of the esoteric, the inner works of the Torah.
Okay, let me try to put this into context. Like, mm-hmm. Were there other movements at the time of Hasidism that were also unorthodox, mystical movements, not Jewish, besides the Jews at that time, also Christian mystics?
There were. Although the influence that they had on the Hasidic movement was very little to none, I would say, because you have to understand at that time, the isolation that the Jewish community found itself with. The Jews were not permitted to live in much of the what was known as the fork of White Russia, Russia, Poland, Lithuania. They were segregated, and they had to live in only certain communities. Many places, big cities, did not allow Jews to live in. Jews were not allowed to engage in certain forms of commerce.
And they were also expelled from much of Western Europe at that time, and they ended up in the area you're talking about.
Yeah, Western and Europe. I mean, the Jews have a long, colorful history of being forced from country to country.
Well, let's get back to what distinguishes Chabad from other Jewish organizations.
So you asked me who my greatest influences were. I would say that my single great influence was the Lubavitcher Rebbe of this generation, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who lived in Brooklyn, New York. He passed physically from this world in 1994.
And he never came to Los Angeles.
He never came to Los Angeles. He was actually, from the time when he came to the United States, he never left Brooklyn, never left New York, I should say.
What was his special teaching?
His special teaching was that every single Jew, and by virtue of that, every single human being is a child of God, is worthwhile. You know, people often say to me, Rabbi, I'm a bad Jew. Rabbi, I don't practice. I don't belong. I have no background. And that's a sad way of looking at things. And that's an incorrect way of looking at their very lifestyle. You see, every Jew, every single human, and by virtue of that, every human being is unique, has tremendous potential to make this world a better place, to make this world a more holy and more refined. And the Rebbe taught love and tolerance for every Jew. You see, at that time, after the Holocaust, the remnants of the Orthodox Jews that came, and there were only a couple hundred of them that came that survived. I would say 95% of the Orthodox community was wiped out in the concentration camps and in Hitler's inferno. The survivors that came to America, and they were very afraid of America. You see, because America was the great melting pot, you know, everybody belonged in, and they felt that there would be no way for them to keep the Hasidic traditions and the Jewish traditions, which in Europe was easier to keep because of the, like we spoke earlier about the segregation. But here in America, everybody was encouraged to assimilate and to become Americans first. And so they fought against this by isolating their communities to the best of their ability. So in the communities in New York of Williamsburg and Borough Park and Flatbush, many great communities were created there by the leaders of the Hasidic sects, the survivors from the camps, and they attracted followers. But as little as possible did they integrate with both the non-Jewish community and the secular American Jewish community, which was the prevalent community at the time.
That's right. I want our listeners to be aware. I took my daughter once to New York, and we were on a train, and we ran into a family of Orthodox Jews, and they couldn't keep my daughter far enough away from them because they didn't really want to mix. They wanted to have nothing to do with Jews that weren't Orthodox.
Yeah. Well, sadly, I mean, that's the way that many of the Orthodox look at the American Jews who are secular or those that are not part of the quote-unquote Orthodox community. I want to stress something before we go on. I personally dislike the labels that we put on ourselves.
Right.
Reform, conservative, Reconstructionist, Orthodox, Hasidic. You know, let me tell you something. Labels often are the elements that divide us in life. The things that we have in common and the things that we're able to have in common, I think are far greater than those that divide us. And we tend to concentrate on the things that divide us, sadly not on the things that unite us. If we were to concentrate on those things that we have in common, those things that are near and dear to our hearts and those things that I believe are the foundational, essential pillars of Judaism, I think we'd all get along better and the world would be a far sunnier, greater place to live in.
Well, can you tell us how Chabad does that? And then we can see if there are lessons there for other communities in Los Angeles.
So I think that and this is part of the reason why I followed in the Chabad movement that I was brought up in, because I have cousins and relatives from other branches, some of the very, very, what's known as Haredi communities in Israel. Mm. And although I respect them as both humans and Jews, and some of them are very fine people, but the way that I believe that Judaism should be worshipped and that Judaism should be practiced and stressed is one where we worship and practice and we celebrate our Judaism through love and through tolerance and through acceptance. You see, often a person who goes to your average Orthodox temple or synagogue will walk in once or twice and usually not come back. Because often they don't feel welcome there. They don't feel like they belong. what makes Chabad unique is that when a person goes into any Chabad house, which is what's known, the Chabad movement has many synagogues, which we call Chabad houses, just like you have, you know, it's a more welcome place. It started on campuses, actually, right here in Los Angeles in the 60s, and today you have over 4,000 Chabad houses throughout the world. But Chabad synagogues and houses and places of worship is that every person is welcomed, every person is respected, every person is given an opportunity to practice Judaism at his or her own level. You see, we don't believe that a person has to become religious or a person has to put on a black hat or grow a beard in order to become a better, more refined person and to celebrate their Judaism. Every person can find the mitzvahs, those commandments and good deeds that talk to them and speak to them in order to become a more elevated soul and a more elevated Jew.
So is that Chabad's mission?
Yes, Chabad's mission is to enhance the Jewish awareness, Jewish pride, and Jewish identity through every single Jew and by virtue of that, every single human being to practice what's called the seven Noahide laws in order to make this world a dwelling place unto God. That is the whole purpose of, you see, Chabad is also very theological. And the question which people often ask is, why are we here? What is this world all about? And why are we here? Are we here? Is our life temporary? Is there a soul? Where does our soul go? What is God? These are all very deep questions, which Chabad philosophy discusses. And you're talking about 200 years of vital and poignant discussion. And the Chabad philosophy teaches that the world was created to make this place a dwelling place unto God. God has plenty of angels and plenty of celestial beings in the higher realms that are what we call goody two-shoes, you know, that don't make any mistakes and are free from sin and free from adversity. And the human being was created flawed. Most of us are deeply flawed. And yet when we use our flaws to better ourselves and to better humanity, this is the entire purpose of the creation of the world. And the world becomes a holier, more spiritual, more elevated place. And I keep using those words because that's the basis of all mankind.
Well, let's try to get down to a level that our guests might be eager to pursue. You know, our first guest was Reverend Sandy Richards.
Wonderful, wonderful Reverend.
First United Methodist Church. Now, her bishop and group is involved worldwide in missions to help the poor and also lesbian, gay, transgender issues. But other parts of United Methodist Church don't necessarily support those. Is Chabad like that? Is Chabad involved in separate missions worldwide, or is every part of Chabad pursuing the same charities and types of community groups to work with?
Well, I mean, the basic fundamental principles of the movement are the same, which is love and tolerance and acceptance and to be of service to our fellow Jews and fellow mankind, wherever we may be. Now, like I said, there are over 4,000 Chabad institutions throughout the world. Every Chabad house is unique both to the rabbi and also to the better half, to his Rebbetzin, his wife, because it's the wife who really keeps the rabbi in line. And it's the wife who allows the community to have a strong feminine presence, which I think is very important. At the same time, in addition to that, every Chabad community is unique to its geographic location. I had the unique opportunity as a young rabbinical student from the ages of 16 through 22 to travel extensively throughout the world, both helping and assisting Chabad communities in Europe and Israel. I studied for a year in London. I had I studied for 2 years in Safed, Tzfas in Israel, which is a very mystical town.
Who arranged all of that, and what was your most moving experiences?
I had many, many moving experiences. I traveled with a group of friends, and our goal was pretty much to study hard and help the communities that we were a part of, but also to tour and to see the world, because I think that travel makes a person wiser, and travel opens up the doors. You know, I grew up in Long Beach, California, and a wonderful place to grow up, but also quite limited if you're stuck in Long Beach, California. It's important to travel, and it's important to see the world. So I did, and I was in many countries. I spent a year in Budapest helping the community there. And my point is that every community was unique. Every Chabad mission had affected the community in its own way. The needs of the community in Budapest are quite different from the needs in Israel. And the needs in Ukraine are different than the needs of the community in Los Angeles. But everybody has the same underlying needs besides for the physical, which is people need love, people need tolerance, people need direction, and people need to live for a more meaningful life and a more meaningful existence.
So what are some of your activities downtown in L.A., both within the Jewish community and in a broader sense?
We came to downtown, and our moving truck moved here in September 11th of 2007. I'll never forget that day that we came to downtown. And we moved here. I didn't know a single person, but I was doing a lot of research, and my wife and I were married already for 2.5 years, and we were looking for a community to start to lay down the foundations of building a Jewish community in a place that didn't yet have one. We looked into several places. We looked into Lake Tahoe. We looked into Gresham, Oregon. We looked into Connecticut. We looked into quite a few places.
Can you, as a Chabad rabbi, can you just go look yourself, or do you have to check with an organization about which job you can take on in which area?
Well, the research is kind of done by the individual. Every regional geographical location has its quote unquote head rabbi or main office, which allows the person or the couple to open up a Chabad house here in California. Rabbi Kunin came out in the early 60s. He's well known. Often people they know him from the Chabad telethon, and he does the menorah lighting in City Hall. Well known rabbi. And the main headquarters here are in Westwood, but we are financially independent. We are, and we do things our way in downtown. I was given the unique honor of leading the Jewish community here in downtown Los Angeles. And to date, we are the only full-time synagogue here. We are the only full-time movement. I mean, we believed in downtown when no one else thought it would happen. I mean, I remember for the first couple of years telling people, oh, you live in downtown. That I live in downtown, we live in downtown, and we have a synagogue in downtown, and they were incredulous. They didn't believe us. And they used to laugh and say, what are you? You're Chabad for the homeless? You're Chabad for the crack addicts? And I used to say, yes, I'm Chabad for the homeless and the crack addicts and for the business people and for the lawyers and for the artists and everybody else who lives in downtown. And it's an honor and a privilege to be the rabbi of downtown Los Angeles. Some of our activities, we have classes that we give, Torah classes that we give throughout the area. We have a weekly service every Shabbat where people come together both Friday night and Saturday morning for prayers. We read the Torah. We have what's called a kiddush. We have some good vodka or some good scotch, which we say l'chaim on. And usually a good lunch meal to go along with that, and it's a sense of community.
How many children are now involved in your synagogue downtown?
Children, very few. I mean, we have regular members are just my kids. You know, this is not unfortunately downtown is not yet the most optimal place for people with children, young families. I believe that it's becoming more and more. I believe all of us have to make an effort if we want downtown to be a more stable area. We need to be more welcoming to families. But I understand it's a work in progress.
What about Cayman's kids? I've seen Payman Tufa.
Payman doesn't live in downtown.
I have seen his kids there.
Maybe they come to visit him.
Oh, okay.
And we have certain people come join us for, you know, different holiday events that work in downtown, or friends of ours, but that live in different places. Unfortunately, many of the people that I know with children, they stay for till the child is two or three, and then they move out of the area. And I think that's it's important to, you know, within the steps that downtown is going through and growing, and some of them are painful steps. I think the new park on Spring Street was a good addition, and there's a lot of acrimony between the dog owners and the children, you know, the parents of the children. And is it a dog park or a family park? These are all, you know, discussions that we need to have. I think in general, what we would like to see is more families moving into the area, more people with children, and that will help the entire downtown be a more solidified area.
Tell us about your family.
My family. Well, my wonderful wife, Rifki.
Who I know well. Yeah. She is wonderful.
Yeah. She's originally from Brooklyn, New York. And we have large families in Chabad. And she's the second to youngest of 10. She has six brothers. All six of them are rabbis. Some of them are rabbis in Colorado. Some of them are rabbis here in California, Redondo Beach, Newport Beach. And we have three beautiful children. Our oldest is Isaac. Our middle child is Zelda. And then our youngest, the little redhead, is Toby. And these are downtown children. Zelda was 6 weeks old when we moved here, and Toby was born here in downtown. So these kids are born and bred, and they're acclimated to the downtown area.
Yeah, I've seen them running around the place.
Yeah. We like to give them as much freedom as we could within safe parameters.
Is the Chabad downtown involved in any reach out activities to the Christian community or other religious leaders downtown, other groups besides the Jewish community?
Well, I try to maintain a friendship. You mentioned Sandy. Sandy Richards is a wonderful reverend, and I sat for a while in the clergy council with LAPD.
What was that like? Tell us about that.
I liked it. I mean, I just, thank God, my schedule is really, really busy, and it's hard for me to attend every meeting with them, but it's good to have. I try to maintain relationships with the clergy from the other churches and houses of worship nearby.
What does the clergy council of the LAPD do?
We get together and try to see what resources that we could bring to the table to help, mainly Skid Row, actually, to help the people on Skid Row. Some drives of products of, remember there was sanitary wipes and baby bottles and baby food and, you know, trying to get our various prospective houses of worships and together and see what we could do to help the community all together. I haven't been active with that for a little while. I've just been pretty busy with other projects, but it's important. I think it's important to have relationships with the other clergy members and houses of worship.
I don't know if you heard that joke about the rabbi that he sold 8 cups of tea out of 1 tea bag. He just made all the customers wait. That reminds me a little bit about some of the community downtown, our own Jewish community downtown. What's it like to deal with the Mizrahi Jewish community? I want to just clarify for our listeners that many of the landlords downtown are not Sephardic Jews, meaning originated in the expulsion from Spain, or Ashkenazi Jews, European Jews. They're really Jews from the Arab world, many of whom have been there for hundreds of years, for centuries, and they have their own unique traditions. What's it like to work with that community? I mean, I can tell you as a broker, it took some special skills, but well, how about as a rabbi?
Well, you know, it's a good question. Many of the property owners here are Iranian or Iraqi Jews. I try to reach out to all of them and to have a friendship with them and to see how we could be of service to them, and also to try to gain their support for our activities here. You see, we are financially independent. There's no outside organization. There's no regional organization that funds us. Every dollar from our activities, which are many, our activities are many, are raised here locally, and we need everybody's contributions. And
so you're saying you and Rivka and your family and the temple has to support itself independently of any central organization?
Absolutely. Well,
no funding from Rabbi Kunin? Or,
no.
No,
okay. Unfortunately, Rabbi Kunin's needs are great. And
I know. He's always asking me for a building. But, you know, so go ahead.
So, yeah, our activities here locally in the downtown area are funded by the Jews of downtown, by the people of downtown. Not only Jews. I actually get some wonderful gifts and contributions from non-Jews as well. I want to give a special shout out to my friend Lewis Perry, who runs the Kadima Security. Wonderful man, elevated man, spiritual man, who he's half black and he's half Puerto Rican, and he loves all of mankind. Just a really great example. And anybody who knows him will smile because they know that Lewis is just a really loving dude.
That's Kadima Security? How Kadima do you spell Security. That?
K-A-D-I-M-A.
Oh, okay. So getting back to your fundraising.
So we have to fundraise from everybody. And people who are able to give us $18, or which is the numerical value of Chai, or $1,800. So every contribution is worthwhile and helps our efforts. I try to encourage the property owners to be generous as well and to give as well. And some are, and some we hope will become a little more generous. What are your experiences, Ed, with dealing with them as a broker?
They don't have to finish a sentence. By the time three words are out of their mouth, I know what they mean. What about, I bet some have been extremely helpful to you.
Some of the property owners.
Do you find that you're more dependent on like just several landlords that help a lot with everything? Or is it a kind of across the board, you manage to get contributions from scores of people, smaller contributions?
Well, it's the smaller contributions that are kind of our bread and butter. The basic needs of the congregation and our activities are funded by the smaller contributions. But we have some. I just want to mention some of the property owners that have been very helpful. Number one is Zuri Barnes and his wife Alma, who our synagogue is in their building, and he's always been a really good friend and very generous in helping us both with the synagogue and with other activities as well. We throw some of our larger young professional parties for Hanukkah in the penthouse, in his penthouse, which we had upwards of 400 people at those parties. Isaac Shamoff and the Shamoff family have been very helpful. Michael Delajani has been very helpful. Steve Needleman has been helpful, among others. So I want to give credit where credit is due. I think that when a person gives charity, you see, the Hebrew word for what we call charity is actually called tzedakah. A lot of people have heard that word tzedakah. Tzedakah comes from the Hebrew word, which means tzedek, which means righteousness. It's not charity. Charity means that I'm helping somebody who otherwise wouldn't be helped, and therefore that makes me a great guy, makes me a wonderful person, which it does. Everybody should give charity. Tzedakah is one step further. Tzedakah, it touches on the very righteousness which the axis of the world turns on. Everything that we have, everything, comes from our loving higher power, from God. The food that we eat, the water we drink, the air that we breathe. Now, if a person is given a lot of wealth, thank God, and they're able to live a very good life. Now, first of all, Judaism doesn't have anything against, there's nothing in Judaism which says a person can't live a good life. You could buy a big house. You could buy a nice car. You could even buy three nice cars and even buy that boat that you always wanted. But it comes a certain point that when you have enough, you have to look and say, look, there's a place which God is, there. This all comes from a higher source. It comes from God. And despite me working hard, which we all work hard, but people that are blessed have to give back. And the Torah actually mandates that 10% of our profits should go to charity. Doesn't matter which charity. The charity is could be your choice. You could give it to a hospital. You could give it to poor people. You could give it to help AIDS in Africa. Whatever that decision is, we respect it and we honor it. But you have to give it away. You know why? Because when you give away, you gain. And it comes back to help you. In life, we only have that which we're able to help others. I want to tell you, can I share with you a little story?
Sure, please.
So there was this billionaire who passed away. Before he passed away, he gathered his children in front of him and he said, listen, right after I die, I want you to read two wills. One will open up immediately after I pass. And the second will, I want you to read 7 days after my passing. He closed his eyes and he died. So right away, his children opened up his first will, which read, in my top drawer, you'll find a pair of red socks. This is my favorite pair of socks, and I wanted to be buried with these socks. Okay? So the children ran to the Chevra Kadisha, to the Jewish Burial Society, and they said, our father left this will. He wants to be buried with the socks. Now, the Chevra Kadisha said, look, your father was a very deeply religious Jew. And according to Jewish religion and according to the halacha and according to custom, we only bury what's called tachrichin, special burial shrouds. We don't bury anybody wearing anything besides that. And therefore, the socks wouldn't be appropriate. The children started to get very upset and they started to scream and yell. But this was our father's last dying wishes. How dare you not allow us to fulfill our father's last wishes? And the Jewish Burial Society was equally adamant. And they said, no, we do things 100% according to tradition. Back and forth, until they went into what's called the Beth Din, the Jewish Court of Law, tribunal of three rabbis. The rabbis heard both the cases and they said, you know, children, we understand how much you loved your father and how much you want to fulfill his wishes. However, you should just know now he's in the world of truth, and although he said that he wanted to be buried with the socks, but now he sees that it would be most beneficial for him to be buried without the socks. Okay, so they buried him without the socks. 7 days later, they opened up the second will, which read as follows. My dear children, by now you would have buried me without my socks. Just know that you could have over $1 billion and not even be able to take a pair of socks with you into the world to come. This is a very, very powerful lesson. You see, a lot of people, they work so hard. They work their entire lives to amass a great fortune. But we all, one day or another, we all have to go face our mortality. And we all go on to the next world. We can't take our money with us. We could only take the mitzvahs. We could only take the people we help, the good deeds that we do, the life that we lived, if it's a spiritual one. That's what's called a more meaningful life, and that's what's called a life well living. I know people, Ed, that have billions, and they're unhappy. And you know some of them too. That's not what causes people to be happy. Happiness comes from within, and happiness comes from living a spiritual life, comes from living a higher and a more elevated life.
Hear, hear. That is wonderful.
I'm practicing all my high holiday speeches with you as well.
I know. We're near a building that I once sold, and the owner made $7 million and still didn't want to pay the commission. So I know exactly what you're saying. He's missing something. He's missing the point.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about what your feelings are about Los Angeles developing with all the different competition for resources and all the different communities involved here? How do you think we can learn from lessons of the Talmud or Torah in helping these communities to live together?
Well, I think, what are the things that divide us? What are the things that really separate people? Usually, if I can't stand somebody else, if there's something that bothers me about a person or a group of people, usually that's a pretext of something deeply uncomfortable from within. You see, Hasidicism teaches us, and Kabbalah teaches us, that anytime you see a problem within somebody else, it's really a mirror of something deeply wrong with you. So before you want to fix somebody else, you have to fix that which is wrong within you. And if you hate somebody, you have to realize you're hating a child of God. You're hating somebody who's also a human being and is also special and precious. Now, people can make mistakes. People can make errors in their life, which they need to do teshuva. Teshuva means to return from, otherwise known as atonement. But in general, we need to concentrate on those things that unite us rather than those things that divide us. And I, you know, growing up in Long Beach, which was part of Los Angeles County, I see improvements. I see people getting along better. I remember the 1992 riots as a kid, and just seeing the city explode in hatred and intolerance. And I think, you know, 20 years later, we've come a long way. We still need to come further. We need to still grow, and that's by recognizing the spark of God in each and every one of us. It doesn't matter if you're black or white or Hispanic or Asian, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, we are all the children of God, and we all have a divine spark within us which shines if we allow it to shine, and we need to see it within each other. That's what's going to bring real peace. That's what's going to bring Mashiach. Mashiach means the time of utopia, when all of mankind will get together. It's written about in the biblical prophets and in scripture about the coming of the Messiah. What the coming of Messiah, what we as Jews believe, it'll be a time of unique world peace where all of mankind will get along. I know it's something very hard to fathom today when you look at what's going on in Syria, you look at what's going on in Egypt, and you look at what's going on in much of the world where there's hunger and starvation and killings and rapings and maimings, and the world can look very bleak. But it's up to every one of us individually. You know how we help Egypt? You know how we help this situation in Syria? It's not only by giving money. Giving money is easy, but it's by becoming more kind and more accepting to each other. Because if we want to change the world, we need to change ourselves. We need to change our immediate community around us. And I think downtown is a wonderful place where to start, because downtown is so unique. You have so many different types of people that call downtown home, you know? And I love downtown heart and soul. I love this place because its potential is through the roof. It's the people that live here are very unique. They come from all over the world. And I think downtown's a wonderful example. If we can make downtown a more tolerant place, and it is quite a tolerant, but there's always room for improvement, and the world will be a better place.
That's a lovely thought. But if the Messiah came to Fifton, Maine, how do you think that would change the situation there? Or in other words, what practical things do you see coming out of your philosophy that could help these different communities get along better? You have, you know, up-and-coming young people moving there for housing. At the same time, you have more and more homeless also coming here. What do you suggest in terms of those communities getting along better?
First of all, there should be dialogue and there should be active involvement between the two of them. I was never one who was against, quote-unquote, gentrification. I was never one who is against the community growing in all parts of downtown. I think if downtown becomes a cleaner, nicer place, it benefits everybody. Does downtown have a tremendous homeless population? It does. Do these homeless people need care and love and services? They do. And the people that have are able to reach out. You know, I always thought about it. If everybody could find one or two people that need a helping hand, and you kind of adopt them as a brother or a sister, doesn't mean you have to have them move into your house, although that would be a wonderful thing. But, you know, you find the people that you have a relationship with. You give them an extra dollar or two. Or even more important, you buy them the food themselves so they can have it. But even more important than that is a pat on the shoulder or a friendly hand or a hug if you're able to. And to tell the people that you are also a child of God and you're also precious, even if you're on the streets and even if you're a drug addict or an alcoholic and you're down and everything in life is just completely in the pits. You know, we that have and we that are not homeless are very fortunate and we're lucky because although these people that are living on the streets are, many of them are mentally ill and many of them have serious addiction. But the fact of the matter is that addiction is an illness, comes from God. And if a person doesn't have the ability to get themselves into AA or any of the 12-step programs and to turn their life about, it's still tragic and they still need, they're still human beings. You know, one of the difficulties of living in the area, and I could tell you this from personal experience, is that sometimes we become desensitized. You know, from the time that I walk from my apartment to my car, I could be asked 5, 6, 7 times to give change or to give money. And living here for, 6 years, that does something. But we can't allow ourselves to become desensitized where we don't view these people as human beings anymore. If you're not able to help them with money, that's okay. But at least look them in the eye, give them a smile if you're able to. And you can make somebody feel good.
Is NIMBYism a problem in Los Angeles?
Absolutely.
So I know that Gloria Molina, I've brought this up on several shows already, tried to set up facilities throughout the basin to care for the homeless, but the Board of Supervisors, nilled it. They voted against it.
Of course.
And downtown became even more a center for homeless treatment.
Yeah. Well, that's.
What does your religion tell you about NIMBYism, if anything?
It's completely wrong. Completely wrong. The person who lives in Malibu and Pacific Palisades and Bel Air has just as much as a responsibility to help the homeless and those that need assistance as the residents that live here in downtown. And that doesn't just mean during the holiday season, on Easter or on Christmas. It means every day of the year. I love it when comes the holiday season. Suddenly, vans and buses and all kinds of volunteers are parading through Skid Row and all the do-gooders are here. Where are you in the middle of August? Where are you on August 26th? People still need they need love and a hand on their shoulder then. I think that we all need to grow and we all need to be more charitable and more people of righteousness, tzedakah.
Tell us a little bit more about Hasidism, which you say really led to the development of Chabad. Now, I read Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust.
Yeah, Yaffa Erlich, right. Good book.
It sure is, but it makes it look like the religious Jews were living in another, almost on another planet, almost separate from the Nazis in terms of their interpretation of reality. They just don't see things the same way.
Well,
what about that?
Well, Hasidicism really stresses on the uniqueness of God in everything and every element. Hasidism teaches us that God is in every single element of the universe, so that this table and this microphone and these headphones that I'm wearing, they all have God inside of them. And how do we bring out the godliness in them? Exactly what we're doing right now. So instead of talking about sex, drugs, and rock and roll on your radio show, which we could do and probably get a good laugh out of it, we're talking about spirituality. We're talking about helping others. We're talking about growth. We're talking about things that are on a higher elevated plane. That's what Hasidicism is all about. Hasidicism is all about bringing out the elements of spirituality. You know, if I may, I have a ram's horn in my hand. What does it look like, Ed? You could describe it.
Well, they can see it on live stream.
Yeah.
But it looks like the horn of a sheep.
Yeah, it's actually a ram's horn called a shofar.
Right.
A shofar we're going to blow on Rosh Hashanah. You know, the a horn of an animal is really something quite base and quite crude. But we hollow it out and we create an instrument of holiness. And before the show's over, I'd like to blow the shofar just as a reminder of Rosh Hashanah, that Rosh Hashanah is coming. It's customary to blow the shofar every single day before Rosh Hashanah. And I want to give a announcement and a plug that anybody who wants to join our services for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we have services in the downtown area in our synagogue, 219 West 7th Street, Suite 206. Rosh Hashanah evening begins Wednesday, September 4th. And we have services on the 5th and the 6th, which is Thursday and Friday, 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. We have Shabbat services on the 7th as well. And then the following weekend, the Saturday afterwards, is Yom Kippur. We have services. Everybody's welcome. Everybody will get a seat. And we try to make our prayers services as interactive and as interesting as possible. We actually don't charge for seats, which is unique, Ed, as you know.
Wow.
It's part of the...
that is unique.
Yeah. Part of the one of the turnoffs that people have is that comes the high holidays, you know, you literally have security guards that don't let people into the synagogue. You have to pay to pray, and we don't believe in the pay to pray. Of course, we welcome all contributions, and if people want to, you know, donate at that time, they're more than welcome to send the donation. But we don't charge because we believe that everybody should have a seat and everybody should be able to come and pray despite their financial situations. So.
Can explain for our non-Jewish listeners what Rosh Hashanah is.
Rosh Hashanah,
Yom Kippur.
Rosh Hashanah, it means the head of the year. It's the Jewish New Year, which historically that is the day that God created Adam and Eve in the sixth day of creation. What it means to us is that every single year, God is renewing His contract, His covenant with mankind. And it's also known as the Day of Judgment, where everything that we will have for this coming year is decided on Yom Rosh Hashanah and then 10 days later inscribed on Yom Kippur. It's a very powerful day. It's a day also where we coronate God as King of the universe, where we recognize His sovereignty. And it's the day where we reflect and we look back at our year and we look at all the things that could have been better, but also all our accomplishments and what could have been done even, and what was done. And we make resolutions. And I'm not talking about resolutions like on January 2nd, where the gyms are full and everybody's pumped up. But then, you know, you go back a couple months later and, you know, people have dropped their resolutions. We really try to take on one more mitzvah, to take on one more good deed, whether it's an act of kindness or to study Torah for 5 minutes more a day or to attend one extra prayer a week. It's something to make us and to help us grow. That's what Rosh Hashanah is all about. And we have all different kinds of customs. We dip the apple in the honey, which many people know about. It's to symbolize the idea of asking God for a sweet new year. We blow the shofar, which is a special commandment to come and hear for everybody to hear the shofar. It's a special good deed. And I think we should end off, right, with the blowing of the shofar.
Well, I have a... Yes, why don't you?
Okay, so
why don't you finish up with the shofar?
Okay. Was a little example of the blowing of the shofar, which you can hear more about that on Rosh Hashanah. And I hope everybody who wants will join us and experience some of the beauty of the holidays.
Wonderful. And now listeners don't have to associate blowing a joint with Skid Row Studios.
Just don't blow, you know. You can't smoke the weed out of the shofar. That's the only rule I have.
Okay, thank you to our listeners, and thanks for Rabbi Moshe Greenwald for coming in here with our pre-Labor Day show.
Thank you, Ed.
And pre-Jewish holidays. Thanks very much.
It's a real honor. Thank you.
Oh, the wayward wind is a restless wind, a restless wind.